Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, newly returned from a lot of excitement in New York City for the James Beard Foundation Awards.
It's been party, hearty, everyone across the globe, it seems, in the last few days, because we're probably not even going to have time to talk about it in today's program, but the biggest bash in the food business in London happened at the Guildhall in London, April 30th, with the announcement of the 100 best restaurants in the world, which they divided into two.
So the first 50, second 50.
And then 51 to 100. And
I really wanted to go to that, but they have only 500 seats, and they had a waiting list of 1,500 people.
They did. If you've been following on the OTM News, you'll know that associated with these awards, Elena Arzak won Best Female Chef, and Thomas Keller got a Lifetime Achievement Award. But more to hand in these United States, we were in New York, as Anne just mentioned, for the annual Love Fest of cooking in the United States, in many different regions and many different categories. But Anne's going to be much better at summarizing that than I am. So what did you think, sweetheart, aside from the fact that it was a hell of a party?
Well, I mean, that's part of what it is. Everybody schmoozing and partying and so forth. It was really good. It's a 25th anniversary, and everybody turned out. I mean, I was most impressed with the shoes. They were sky high and very elaborate.
And that was just...
It's a black tie event.
And that was just the guys.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, there were a number of upsets in the winners category, as there always are, although there are also standards. I mean, the same people seem to show up year after year after year. There was a surprise in the best chef category because it was assumed that one of the senior chefs would have gotten that award. But instead, it went to somebody who, by the way, totally deserved it, Daniel Hume, he's young. He was young compared to the other chefs, but absolutely a brilliant chef. And I think that one of the criteria is whoever's the best chef sets standards and influences generations, and he's certainly going to do that. He's at 11 Madison Park, and then at another restaurant which we visited, which we adored, Nomad. We'll have to get them on for an interview. We didn't manage to interview the chef de cuisine there while we were there, but we did eat there, and I was in love with the best halibut I ever had in my whole entire life, with, I think, four different kinds of spring peas. It was just the most brilliant thing.
Yeah, and when Anne says it's the best dish she's ever had, that means her food memory. Nevertheless, it truly was a remarkable dish, and was also a very large portion, because I got to eat quite a lot of it too.
Yes, but some of the other winners, restaurant.
And what fun it was to meet Jeff Tascarella, who we met at a restaurant called Tenpenny a year ago.
Right.
Now installed as the general manager at Nomad, which is quite a place.
Yeah.
And we didn't think we had a chance of getting into 11 Madison Park, and we were probably right. It turns out there were special tables at many of the restaurants in New York across the whole long weekend that we were there.
There were so many after parties. I mean, there were five that I knew of, and we talked to somebody who said that they closed up their restaurant party, after party, at 3 in the morning. And, of course, some of these people had to be up bright and early to work again the next day. And, in fact, who was it showed up on the Today Show cooking the next morning as well? You can get the entire list of these winners on jamesbeard.org and check on who won the Restaurant Chef Awards. They also have journalism awards, broadcast awards, book awards. The best book for this year went to that Modernist Cuisine, which is a $450 multi-volume series.
I guess they made off with the prize just because they had more poundage in the event than anybody else did.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of our friends won prizes in this, and the, I guess, Mid-Atlantic was a surprise. It was from somebody from Hoboken who I understand has really worked and put in her dues. And it was nice that there was a woman who won too, Maricel Priscilla.
Since you're always backing the ladies, you should mention that Christina Tosi from David Chang's organization won for her
Milk Bar. The very first pastry chef who ever won a Rising Star Chef Award.
So there was a lot going on.
And we love the best chef in New York. We love Michael Anthony of Gramercy Tavern.
Yeah, and we're going to catch up with him soon and bring him to the program as well. So.
Yeah, we have, stay tuned because we have engaged a number of these winners to come on the show and do interviews with us in the future. It was just too crazy and too wild in the press room to do what we usually do is on-site interviews, but we'll be rotating through the winners if you just follow on the menu every week.
So we'll make up for that. And in the meantime, we did have a chance to find three extraordinarily fine young men with back in the kitchen, and we're bringing those to you today because you'll certainly want to look them up as well. And first in the honor parade, I guess you might call it. Actually, we're doing them alphabetically, so.
No favoritism.
No favoritism whatsoever. But the fact that the first chef, Aaron Chambers from Bulu Sud, who was a native-born Yorkshireman like I am,
you can
see why we managed to sneak him in and perhaps why we chose alphabetical order as the way to go.
But I love Bar Bulu.
Bulu Sud. Imagine this, a Yorkshireman cooking Southern French cuisine for a restaurateur, an immensely successful one who came from Lyon, where you can't even smell the sea.
When you're in a restaurant where everything tastes good, you wonder what to order. We had some help, and we had wonderful food. We're actually going to be talking Aaron Chambers about his menu. He's the chef de cuisine at this restaurant that's part of the Daniel Bulu Empire. And Peter's very happy because Aaron is from Yorkshire, which is where Peter is from, East Riding, and Peter is from the West Riding, which is like night and day.
We would both be honest if we said that the best cooked food in the world does not come from our home county, however much we love it. Am I right, Aaron?
I'd like to say yes, but my mother would kill me if I could say something like that.
Well, my mother's not listening, and I'm allowed to say that because I survived childhood, but it was touch and go. But things have happened in England in cuisine, but you left there a long time ago at an early age.
Yeah, it's been 9 years since I lived in England, 2 in Dubai, and the last 7 in America.
Now, the restaurant we're talking about, actually, is Bulu Sud, which is like, I mean, we follow every single one of Danielle Bulu's restaurants. And we fell in love with this one like last year, just before it was going to open. And how was it done? Is it done very well? It's gotten great reviews.
Yeah, we've been very, very fortunate with the reviews. We've done very, very well. We'd always like to do a little bit better, but can't complain about what people have said. The menu is always evolving. We're a better restaurant than we were 1 year ago. I think we built as a team. We molded the kitchen, and the menu ideas are getting better and better and more exciting, I believe.
Now, you were the opening chef at this restaurant.
I actually started on the Bulu Sud project last February, 2011. And then I developed the menu with Danielle, and then we started to train staff in March, April, and then we opened in early May last year.
Now, you were where before that?
I was the executive sous of Café Bulu in New York City.
Okay, great.
So I worked with Gavin for almost 2.5 to 3 years. So I helped Gavin with the running of Café Bulu. Obviously, he's very busy with Boku Store and stuff like that. So it was a chance for me to see how it is to have a lot to do with the restaurant and help train the cooks.
But now you got off to what we might call a sort of flying start in your cooking career in England because you work for another Frenchman who's rather famous.
Yep. When I was, I think I was 19, I joined Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons, which is Raymond Blanc. Spent 2 amazing years there. And to be honest, that's pretty much shaped my career. It gave me the inspiration and the drive and the passion to do what I do today.
tell us what the concept is of Bulu Sud, which I love, absolutely love it.
Okay, we're very fortunate that Danielle wanted to do a Mediterranean restaurant, so we have a lot to play with. Danielle's idea when we came up with the menu was to do three sections to the menu. Do La Ferme, which is the meat. We do La Portage, which is the vegetables. And then we do La Mer.
He's big on La Mer.
He's very big on the sea, and the Mediterranean is based around the sea. The whole menu is based on around the countries that touch the Mediterranean Sea. So we have a lot of seafood on the menu.
Now, we've already eaten, so I'd like to just sort of touch on some of the stuff that we had that was so great. Now, well, we didn't actually have this Moroccan carrot salad, but, I mean, I have to tell you, everybody's talking about carrots nowadays. Why?
Why? Carrots are good for you.
They've always been good for you. Your mother's always said that it helped your eyes.
Yeah, the vitamin D inside, which helps with night vision and vision in general.
But this is getting pretty over the top, this carrot thing.
I know. I've always loved carrots. I don't know what to say. Ever since my dad, my dad's grows all his organic vegetables at home, so we've always had the carrots with the dirt.
Now you grew up in Yorkshire, but the opposite end of Yorkshire from my husband, Peter, because he was in West Yorkshire, which is mainly industrial, textile industry. You were East Riding, which is the eastern part, and you had a farm you grew up on with the fresh milk and all that stuff.
No, definitely. It was beautiful. No, I think carrots are great for you. And the salad we're featuring on the menu is a Moroccan carrot salad. So the carrots are baby carrots, which are roasted with a little cumin and some salt and some olive oil. Very, very simple. And then we serve the salad with some grapefruit segments. We do a black olive puree on the bottom. And then me and my exec sous chef, Travis Weicker, we go to the market. And we get all the beautiful fresh greens we can from the market. So in the salad this week, there is some lamb's quarters.
Grows in my backyard, I might tell you.
They grow in everybody's backyard, but nobody knows what they are. So there's lamb's quarters, there's some mustard frills, there's some spinach, and I think there was some market arugula as well.
Now, I'm looking at this thing I absolutely loved, which was a salad tropeziana.
Tropeziana.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, crisp, light salad, excellent for the summer. A little artichoke puree on the bottom, and then just shaved raw vegetables. So it's raw fennel, celery, and artichoke. Lemon and a white balsamic dressing. It's a beautiful salad.
And I loved also sea urchin and crab tartine.
We should change the name to Taste of the Sea because
that's it. The seaweed was fabulous.
Yeah, the seaweed rye toast that we make in house is fantastic. Santa Barbara sea urchin is the best you can get in America. The Maine Piquito crab, to my belief, is the best crab you can get in America.
Now, where does that come from?
Maine.
It's
like the stone crab.
It is a stone crab, huh? Okay.
It's called a piquito. You've heard of piquito before.
Yeah, I didn't know it was piquito.
But it's a hard shell crab.
Yeah.
Okay, my most favorite thing, of course, was the octopus a la plancha with Marcona almonds. Who would expect that? And what else goes with that?
Well, you wanted to ask
arugula
Chef.
And
you wanted to ask Chef how he got the octopus to be so tender.
I thought you did sous vide.
No, we just do a very, very traditional method. We blanch the octopus first in boiling salted water with lemons inside, and then we shock it in ice, and then we tie them up in a cheesecloth individually, and then we cook them in a court bouillon with white wine and vegetables and thyme, garlic, and some minimal spices, and we just do a slow braise in the water.
You're supposed to beat them against the rocks.
Well, when I have something to do that for me. When I buy them, I buy tenderized. So I buy Spanish tenderized octopus.
And they have beaten them against the rocks.
That's traditionally the method, but I think the method they use now is they have a big steel drum, kind of like the inside of a washing machine.
Oh, yeah?
And they pump it full of seawater, and they spin the octopus inside, and they kind of crash and tumble against the side, which tenderizes them.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah. We hope the octopuses are dead before they start that.
Oh, no, that's really brilliant. I never knew that. Nobody's ever told us that.
No, I have this fun memory when I went to Greece, and I think when I was 7 or 8 years old, my parents. And we went to this little island, the island of Simi. And we were having lunch at this restaurant by the shore. And I could see all these stuff drying on the rocks. And I saw this diver coming out and beating something, and I just didn't know what it was. And my father later told me that the guy was tenderizing the octopus on the rocks after he caught
him. Yeah, that's basically.
And then they hang him up. They hang him up to dry him out.
Now we actually managed to make it all the way to main courses, which is not the easiest thing to do. There were so many traps along the way.
We love the Lebanese spiced pollock. With
yes,
red
that's, well,
pepper,
bulgur,
cucumbers, and cumin yogurt.
Well, I was thinking that, I mean, we think of fish cuisine in Italy and in Spain and in Greece, but not so much in the other parts of the Mediterranean. But obviously we're wrong. The Lebanese, not really a very maritime country.
I think 80% of the coastline, I mean, I think Lebanon is pretty much, it's on the coast all the way down. It's a very, very long, thin country to just...
But you found an American fish.
Yes, well, we're in America. I have a lot of Mediterranean fish on the menu, and it's expensive. And so for our lunch menus, we normally go to a local fish that we can source fresh and get the same day. We get fish delivered every day of the week. So we went with pollock because it's a beautiful fresh fish. I think it's a very underrated fish. I think it's a beautiful flavor. It's very flaky like cod. It's a beautiful fish. And the spice is good in a big fish like that because the fish really draws.
And we must have one last place of honor.
Peter's freaked out over the dessert.
As you follow on the menu is not the world's greatest reviewer of desserts. But there was a dessert that we were informed was out of this world. Speak to that since your pastry chef is not here.
Yeah, I can speak about it. It's the grapefruit givre. It's a beautiful dessert that Chef Geyer has actually been nominated for the James Beard Award tonight. On Monday night we're going to the James Beard Award.
What's her name again?
Chef Geyer. She's nominated for Standing Pastry Chef.
Through
this restaurant and Barbalud, she's also the pastry chef of Barbalud.
Well, if I had a vote, she'd have my vote.
Well, hopefully on Monday night she can seal the award. The dessert is a beautiful grapefruit that they hollow out the inside, and then they make a sorbet out of the juice of the grapefruit, and then they freeze the inside, and then they put the sorbet back inside. They smush it along the sides, and then inside they put some rose cocoon. Which is like it's like a little Turkish delight. When you know you're a kid, it's like the jellified rose flavor.
I didn't
flavor.
Eat any, but Peter knows all about
this. I ate almost every mouthful. There were only about 5 gazillion calories.
No. It's definitely worth it. Then also inside we have some, there's some sesame cream. There's also some sesame crumbles, which is like... it's sesame and butter and flour, and they make like you would a cobbler mix for the top of the crumble. It's kind of like that we bake in the oven. And then also there's on the top is a little a sugar twill on the top, and then some halva hair on the top. That was the hair on the top of the dessert. And then you're supposed to like, smash down with a spoon and dig in and try and get a little bit of everything.
He did that.
It's fantastic.
Oh yeah, I was
hello.
I was a banger from the top down.
Okay, you've been absolutely wonderful. You recommended the right things for us to order. We loved everything we had. Where do you envision this is going to go? I mean, this is like a startup, really. A year in,
I think we've done very, very well. The whole idea for the restaurant when it was from base up was that we were to be underneath Café Balud, but kind of above the rest of Danielle's restaurant. So Restaurant Danielle has 3 Michelin stars. Café Balud has 1. Trying to get 2. Hopefully they're going to get 2 soon.
Okay.
We kind of like a Michelin star, but there's a lot of work to go, and we hope the reviewers come back and review us again because...
I have not read a bad review. Everybody loves the place.
We would like
congratulations to you about that.
No, thank you very much. It's a lot of hard work pays off.
What isn't is worthwhile, not hard work.
So if you started out in Beverly, East Riding of Yorkshire, and set on your way, would the pathway have been any different? Or is this like a dream come true?
No, it's a dream job to be a chef of one of Danielle's restaurants. Let's think about it. He has, in New York City, he has, 6 restaurants and an apiary, so he only has 6 head chefs. So it's a bit of an honor to work for Danielle.
I think you're good and you're cool, so I mean, I really enjoyed it.
So if we asked your mom and dad, they would say, Aaron did okay?
They're very happy with what I do, and they're very proud of me, and they always wish me the best.
Have they had a chance to come?
They've been, well, I'm actually getting married this summer.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm getting married.
You're a Yorkshire girl?
No, she's actually from New England. She's from Massachusetts. So we're having a wedding up in Ipswich. But my parents have been two or three times. They've been twice this year, and they're going to come again once more. So I've been very lucky.
I mean, what kind of wedding? I mean, I'm reading Restaurant Man, Joe Bastianich's book, and he talks, his mother invited 550 people to his wedding.
I hope it's not going to be that many. I think we're around 200, but I like to keep it.
Well, we wish you all the best. We think your future is assured, and we can't wait to come back a couple of years from now and find out how things have changed.
Thank you very much for coming.
Aaron, thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
I'm glad you enjoyed everything.
And we'll be back with another Young Star Chef right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, well, welcome back.
Yes, I wanted to mention to you, we were remiss in not getting to see Daniel Boulou, who we always see there. I know he was there, and I just adore Daniel. So if Daniel's listening, sorry we missed you, and we will be back to see you soon. Next up, we have, what a revelation this was. Here, Alex Stupak is the chef at Empyrean Cucina, and he has two restaurants, actually. He will explain that in the interview. And that he's absolutely amazing, and our food was amazing. And I have this whole new idea for guacamole after being in his restaurant. And we also have a whole new idea about agave spirits, talking to Matt Riesler,
who happens to be his brother-in-law.
We're going to have a lot of fun tonight because we're visiting with Alex Stupak, who I've admired from afar for a while, but I've never met, who was most famous as a modernist pastry chef and now is into something totally different, and he's getting a lot of ink out of your new venture, Alex, your Empyrean Empire, shall I call it, both at the Taqueria and the Cocina.
I'm not sure if two restaurants counts as an empire yet, but that sounds great.
I could see this in your future. Well, you've done a lot for someone who's only 32 years of age.
Thanks.
Starting out, as I read, even though it was only dishwashing, you were interested in restaurants when you were 12 and were washing dishes in your hometown of
Leominster.
Yeah, I don't know. Where is that?
Leominster is about 45 minutes west of Boston. It's just a small town in the center of the state.
So that's why you ended up being in Boston.
Yeah, it was the closest metropolitan area I could get my hands on. So,
but you've really worked in some knock your socks off, exploratory, experimental, molecular restaurants.
I've been lucky who I've gotten to work with.
Yeah,
for sure.
True.
Mm-hmm.
Alinea.
Yep.
My favorite, widely Dufresne WD-50.
My favorite, too.
Yeah, I love them. Absolutely love them. And then all of a sudden, here you are at the top of your field here as a pastry chef, modernist pastry chef, and you just took a leap out and opened a Mexican restaurant.
Yep.
Explain to us that. There's a lot of curiosity in the culinary community about whatever produced this.
Well, it's actually precedented for me personally. Career-wise, a huge shift or change has actually happened before. It's just the first time it happened to me, no one knew who I was and no one cared.
What was that?
So, well, I started off cooking savory. I started off as a cook, and I had no interest in pastry. I did not study pastry in culinary school, and somehow I became a pastry chef, and I did it without working under anyone else. So that was a huge and dramatic shift for me.
But you had total control of what you were doing in that department.
I did, and that was part of the reason I wanted to do that. But for whatever reason, call it a personality defect, but I'm a big fan of jumping into something well before I'm prepared for it.
So you didn't know all that much about Mexican, did you?
No. I mean, and I really still don't. The thing with Mexican cooking and opening a Mexican restaurant is that once you open a restaurant of any sort, you have to look at it as a marriage or a lifetime commitment. And for me, Mexican cooking, it's an endless source of inspiration. And I can't stop thinking about how many different fascinating ways that great Mexican food can manifest. So for me, there were a million reasons, but that being kind of the last point that really drove me to do it.
And now your wife is pastry chef here. Right.
Well, she's pastry chef for both restaurants, but she's based out of Cocina,
okay,
yeah.
But she has some Mexican connection.
Well, she was born in Los Angeles. Her mother is Mexican.
Oh, well, that close. Okay.
Yeah, and she was brought up with really great, what I'll call California-style Mexican cooking, which is delicious, and it's nothing like what we're doing now, but it and she were my portal into this way of cooking. That was the introduction.
Anything having to do with authentic.
No, I dislike using the word authentic, and I dislike using the word traditional.
Right.
Because it stirs up the wrong emotions in some people. I mean, the fact of the matter is there are people who've been cooking Mexican cuisine authentically their entire lives. So for them to hear someone claim that something is authentic when they've only been doing it for a year and a half.
Right, I can see that.
Well, that would make me upset if I was in their position. I will argue that everything we do is Mexican at its core, but little to nothing that we do is authentic or traditional in any way.
We'll go along and you can point out some of the differences. I mean,
sure.
The word, the name of the restaurant, Empion, I just learned is a form of to push in Mexican.
Yeah.
I mean, Spanish.
Yeah.
Is it Mexican dialect or is it Spanish? Oh, it'd be Spanish directly.
It's actually Spanish.
Yeah, I know the word now.
Yeah, I hear often from people who've been speaking Spanish as their first language, well, what does that word mean? And I actually like that because, to me, I like things that are obscure or lesser known. So
why do they ask that? I mean, they don't know how it applies to a restaurant.
Or they never heard the word. They've never
really?
Heard that form of the word push. Empujar is a much more common
right.
form of the word push. Empeón, as far as I understand it, is to push in an aggressive way.
Uh-huh.
To push something or someone out of your way. So
you're not doing that.
Well, if anything, the way I think about the word is that the only thing that stands in between me and doing what I want is myself. So the only real person that I'm pushing is myself.
Now, did you have kind of wacky, quirky, or do you have wacky, quirky tacos at the taqueria?
Wacky or quirky, I don't think so. We have some unusual tacos, or what I think would seem unusual to some people. The evolution of our taqueria is going to be one of we want a dining experience that's built around tacos. Again, we're not a traditional taqueria. We have too many amenities that make us a restaurant. So we are, in fact, a restaurant that serves tacos. But we look at tacos as an opportunity to enjoy a product, the same way that sushi is an opportunity to enjoy a product. It informs you how to eat and it informs you how to enjoy something. So rather than think of it as fast food or food that you prefer to eat when you're drunk or standing up or whatever people perceive a taqueria as, we're trying to just make it a way or a style of dining there.
Now, is it similar, because I've not seen it in decor, because I love this ambience. It's something, the feel of it is really good. It's a really warm feel. And yet it's not overly decorated like you get a lot of the Mexican restaurants.
Right.
So tell us about the decor. I'm looking at the eye of this blue bird. Tell me about that.
It actually was, I was walking down Houston Street, and I saw that this mural, this beautiful mural that was spray painted, and I tracked down the artist who did it.
Did you?
Yeah.
And it was like graffiti?
Yeah. Yeah. It was actually from a street artist who goes by the name of Gaia. He's a really young guy, really talented, and I just called him up and asked him if he would be interested in doing some work in the restaurant. So ultimately, with the decor of the place, it's all in the family. We haven't hired a designer yet because we haven't had the luxury of being able to afford one. But we have friends and family and my wife Lauren and people who have basically all put their mark or all helped us to build the dining room. So in that way, it's very eclectic and it worked out. it really worked out. But it was done without a plan or very little of a plan.
That's charming. We sort of skipped over something that I wanted to just jump back to. Is you also, another reason for doing this is you wanted to invest in something beyond what you viewed as kind of a tiring trend of experimental modernist cuisine, right?
Well, I mean, my attitude is this. It's that thinking about food is never going to go out of style. But modernism, to me, I actually dislike the term. To me, it's a term that's more appropriate for...
Well, nobody likes any of the terms. Nobody likes molecular gastronomy.
Sure, but...
Nobody likes experimental.
But we also have no right to complain because we've clearly failed in coming up with a better term.
There is no term.
But to me, modernist cooking, the focus was on the technique rather than the result.
Yeah.
At least that's how I personally define it.
That's my objection to it, by the way, although I've had really, really good things I've eaten at El Bulli.
Of course.
You know, yeah.
There's good and bad in every iteration of cooking, just like there's good Italian food and bad Italian
but
food.
But I think the imitators of that
are
terrible, absolutely awful.
Yeah, it's difficult.
I've had some of those meals, and they're just dreadful.
Yeah, absolutely. unfortunately, I think... Some of the side effects of that movement is that it inspired chefs to grab onto it, but they lost sight of what matters most, which is the flavor. And like you said, when you eat at El Bulli, nothing is lacking in flavor. There's still a soul about the cuisine, and
there's one of him. There's all these imitators.
Of course, no, you can't mimic him. It would be like trying to steal the moonwalk from Michael Jackson. Like
exactly.
You clearly know who they stole that from. And you're never going to do it as well.
So, okay, so you took this great leap into another whole thing, a cuisine that has been around now for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
And has, did you kind of, when you were in Chicago, did you hang with Rick Bayless?
I never hung with Rick Bayless. The closest I ever got to him was befriending his chef de cuisine at the time. His name was Brian Enyart, and I had just met him briefly a couple times, but even at that point, I hadn't begun to really ask questions about Mexican cooking. I hadn't made the decision yet to open a Mexican restaurant. But years later, I ended up connecting with him again, because he had worked there for, I think, like 9 or 10 years, maybe even longer. So obviously, he knows an immense amount of about Mexican cooking. He absorbed a great amount of knowledge from Rick.
Oh, well, they have outings. I mean, they educate everybody in the outings to Mexico.
No,
pilgrimages, just about.
What Rick has done is his body of work is incredible. It's really admirable. So,
yeah, but this is not so. Instead of saying that this is not that kind of an approach, what kind of approach can we expect? And you might be able to tell us about that by going through some of the items that you expect we'll be eating tonight.
Sure.
Could you do that? Describe it? Our listeners love food porn and verbally as well as pictorially.
Absolutely. So we begin with some reference point within Mexican cuisine as a source of inspiration. And then we take that reference point and we basically decide as cooks personally what we're going to associate it with. So, for example, right on the top of the menu, something that's on every table is our guacamole. But our guacamole is unusual. Our guacamole is flavored with pistachios. Reason for that is dual-fold. We were basically trying to decide. We were basically sitting around eating avocados to describe the flavor profile in its pure form, without any onion, without any cilantro, without any lime juice, because you rarely taste avocados that way when you think about it. And we kept coming up with the flavor of nuts. We kept saying, well, they remind me of the flavor of almonds, or they remind me of the flavor of walnuts. It's a very subtle, elusive flavor. We arrived at pistachios because the interesting thing about pistachios and avocados is that from a color standpoint, from a chromatography standpoint, they're very similar because they're both that beautiful, vivid green on the outside. And when you split them open, they're that olivey yellow on the inside.
That's true. I never thought of that.
Yeah. So we just decided to make a simple guacamole, but flavor it with pistachio, put actual roasted pistachio in it, and it tasted great. And to drive the flavor home even more, we made a pistachio salsa that has some tomatillo and green chili in it to echo the flavor further. And then rather than serve it with chips, we serve it with these, we call them masa crisps, but it's an invention of the pastry chef, Lauren, where she actually takes a traditional tamal batter, but instead of steaming it, she spreads it thin on a baking sheet and bakes it. And you have this crisp cracker that has it really showcases the unique textural nature of masa, and it somehow simultaneously also like a really good sablé or puff pastry or something like this.
I'm getting excited about this.
Yeah. So again, it's like I'll argue that it's a Mexican dish, but I've never seen guacamole served in
no,
this way. So I can't say it's authentic or traditional. Another dish, again, we have mole poblano on the menu, which
I was going to ask you about that.
So that's Mexico's most famous mole, right? What would happen is that mole would be mixed with chicken broth, and then chicken would be stewed in it for hours and hours, and you would get a bowl of it with some sesame seeds on top, right? We took the mole and we decided to do something different with it. We took the mole and we actually toss carrots in it and roast them at a low temperature, really slow and low, so they get really sweet. Again, typically moles, when you finish them, you season them with a little bit of sugar to help balance the astringency of the chile. And rather than season them with sugar, we decided to pair them with a sweet vegetable. And that's how we balance the flavor of the mole. So that was the logic behind it. Again, not traditional at all, but it's lighter and newer way to enjoy a really ubiquitous Mexican flavor.
Well, I mean, this is you're thinking all the time here.
It's all based on very personal association. So I don't think
you have oysters here.
We do.
Tell me about this.
So they're Shigoku oysters. They're a West Coast oyster. They're really mild and creamy. We actually poach them very gently and then chill them, and they're set on top of a flan. But it's not a sweet flan. It's a savory flan that's been flavored with shellfish. So mussels and clams, basically. And also on that flan, we put some pools of chilmole. Chilmole is a Yucatecan seasoning paste that's made from achiote and spices and, most interestingly, chilies that have been burnt to the point of ash. So it's black and it's smoky and it's bitter and it's extremely robust. It's usually used to rub on meat and then grill it. But we took the chilmole and basically diluted it with some of the oyster liqueur, the natural water inside the oyster, and used it as a sauce for it.
I have a whole bunch of one hand sort of, I've called them opulent ingredients, like sea urchin. And,
sure.
And then you also have just some unusual ingredients. I mean, the other one I was looking at was the Wagyu skirt steak tartare. But you use interesting ingredients such as the hen of the woods mushrooms. What else do you have here?
Sure. Well,
you use rabbit. I mean, it's really not your run-of-the-mill restaurant. It's really very exciting.
Well, again, it's funny. For whatever reason, in most Mexican restaurants, I don't know why everything has to revolve around chicken and skirt steak and pork and shrimp. I don't know why those have to be the four proteins. They're great proteins, and we certainly have examples of those on the menu, but people do eat wild game in Mexico. People do eat copious amounts of seafood and huge varieties of it. So my attitude is that any great local ingredient we can be part of the menu. And we also try to look for Mexican ingredients that you see less and less, like on the Wagyu skirt steak. So we serve skirt steak here, and the only thing that makes it unusual is we actually serve a tartare. We actually serve skirt steak minced up and flavored with red chile. And also,
what's this?
Wahe seeds.
Yeah, what is
so
that?
A wahe is actually the seed of an acacia tree. And,
really?
Yeah, they come in. They're green seeds, and they have a very intense sort of umami, mushroom-like flavor, and a texture almost like an edamame, like a fresh soybean. And they're eaten in Mexico. Sometimes they're just eaten raw out of the pod as almost like a snack, but also as a dietary supplement. They're very healthy for you.
I see.
But they're also sometimes put into moles and sauces. Wahe mole is a mole. Again, when you read it, you're confusing it with guacamole, but it's a mole of wahes. And again, if you think of eating skirt steak, it's not far-fetched to enjoy the flavor of mushrooms with that. So there's mushrooms in the skirt steak tartare, but to drive that umami flavor home, we used a Mexican source of umami rather than a Japanese source of umami, which I think is interesting.
I guess it's kind of fresh out of the gate to ask you about a signature, but is there something here that you wouldn't be able to take off the menu that people look for?
No, I don't think so. I'll shoot myself in the foot by saying that because in creativity, you're always trying to avoid a signature dish.
I know.
The idea is to create a great dish and then remove it. And I'm on the fence about it because ultimately if someone wants to come back and have a dish that they loved, I want it to be there for them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also want to keep the kitchen in a constant state of evolution. We're only 4 months old now, so I think it's premature to say that there's a dish on the menu that I can't take off yet.
Well, there's so many on here that I don't know. I mean, I hope you're thinking about what you're going to pick because there's so much on here that I love. I wouldn't have a clue how to start. One thing we should mention, and then we're going to talk to your tequila person about the tequila.
Also my brother-in-law.
Your brother-in-law?
Yeah, that's Lauren's. That's Lauren's brother.
Oh, so, that's great.
So this is very much a mom and pop operation.
I was just going to say. Because of Lauren, I think we absolutely better mention a couple of desserts, right?
Well, I mean, again, I'm reluctant to talk about the desserts because she's the pastry chef and she's in charge of them, but she has some really great ones. She makes a marquesote, which is this traditional Mexican cake. It's really dense and it's heavy in vanilla flavor, and it actually has orange marmalade baked into it on the bottom of it, and it's so, so good. But, again, you'll find in her menu there's interesting things like amaranth, which is used very traditionally in Mexican sweets, but she takes it out of context and serves it with this mango mousse that I think is incredible. But ultimately, I don't talk about her desserts because she deserves to speak about them herself. So.
Well, Alex, I can't wait. This looks just divine. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, I can't pronounce Epion either. But it is the name of a second restaurant owned by Alex Stupak, as you probably already know. What you don't know so far is the involvement of another member of the family in a very important aspect of wining and dining in Mexico. Because, after all, I thought I knew the answer to the question, what do you drink with Mexican food? The answer is either beer or probably Coke. And those turn out to be absolutely the wrong answer.
Coke.
And we have Matt Ressler, who is a member of the family involved with this establishment, who can answer that question by giving us the right answer. First of all, Matt, welcome to On the Menu Radio. We're delighted to catch up with you. And now, what's the answer?
Well, I personally feel as though that no other cuisine in the world matches quite as well as tequila and or mezcal does with Mexican cuisine. You can have some great wines go with French food and Italian food for that matter as well. But Mexican food, I do believe that tequila or mezcal is probably the best bet to go.
Instead of cerveza.
Cerveza is always great as a secondary, but for sipping, I would definitely say mezcal.
Okay.
And what's the difference between tequila and mezcal?
The basic way to state it is that mezcal is actually cooked underground, so it gives it more of a smoky flavor. Tequila is generally cooked in autoclaves, which is basically a giant pressure cooker.
Okay. Plus tequila is a purer representation of the juice of the agave, too.
Well, tequila is made from the Blue Weber agave, whereas mezcal can actually be made from 28 different species of agave. There are over 200 species of agave in the world. 28 to 30 of them have enough sugar content in them to be distilled into a spirit. So basically, mezcal's it has a broader spectrum than tequila does.
But because you have a sipping liquor, you're going to sip a little more slowly than you would, for example, if you were drinking wine with a meal.
Well, I mean, I think people can savor the quality of mezcal and tequila just as much as they would the quality of wine.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's just the imbibing process will be a little slower. Otherwise, you might finish up being a little more inebriated before and you might not get through your dinner.
Possibly.
How many are on this list?
I was going to come back to that one next. So we've got the concept. Now, how did it get so far off the rails that you have so many?
We actually do a lot of diligence in picking and choosing which tequilas and mezcals are actually going to go on our list. Currently, we have about 75 different tequilas on our list. Not all of them are the full expression, so we don't just carry the Blanco, Reposado, and Añejo of everything. We'll choose which ones actually fit our cuisine the best. So that may mean that a Blanco shows a true expression of agave, but their Reposado falls short. Their Añejo may pick up some spice in it that we need for our food. So therefore, we pick and choose the type of tequila that we think fits our cuisine the best. Same thing with our mezcals.
And beyond the typical show of liquor bottles behind the bar, you have a rather unusual thing. Let's call it a tequila tower.
Or agave tower, yeah.
Agave tower.
Agave tower. Now, how did you ever learn so much? Were you always an expert on the...
I've always been a student of spirits, and I've always been a fan of mezcal. This obviously catapulted it, as in me doing research every day, studying about it. Mezcal is a very misunderstood spirit, and I just like to know as much as I can about it myself. That way, when somebody comes in with questions, I can answer it to the best of my ability. Generally, if I don't know the answer to it, and somebody does give me a question that I'm not sure of, within that evening, I'll do my research and have an answer for them next time they come in.
I mean, will you really know that one particular tequila or one particular grade will go better with a particular dish?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay.
So tonight you're going to match tequila and mezcal with what we're eating?
If you'd like, I can do that. I can definitely do that with some mezcal and some tequila if I know what dishes you're having.
We would certainly fail to do it ourselves.
We would never.
I have just one last question,
sure.
Because I'm sure you have a lot to do to get ready for this evening's traffic. You have beautifully written list of all your tequilas on a sort of a curved wall overlooking the tower.
Yeah, Chef Lauren.
Okay, so what happens when you get another one?
Well, actually, I did threaten her with that. I mentioned when she was painting it that she's going to have some trouble.
So
because
your
I'm going to continue. Absolutely,
it.
She did that herself. She does a lot of little touches around the restaurant, along with the spice and the mole recipes on the window over there. She did all of the tequilas and mezcals on the wall, and that was one thing that I joked with her, is that she's going to have to find more room, because I plan on bringing in quite a bit more.
But perhaps this one list isn't quite up to date.
It's not up to date. There's about five mezcals that we do not have on there that are they're on our list, but they're not on the wall yet.
Great.
And if somebody wants to come in for a tasting, you do those too?
Absolutely. We actually currently on our list are our cocktail list as well. We do have three different types of flights, if you will. One of them, Rocio's Rounds, which is Rocio is the donkey that pulls the tojono. Tojono is the giant wheel that crushes the piña in the mezcal making process, and Rocio is the donkey for Fidencio's distillery. So we paid homage to it by naming a flight after it. And then we also have a flight of wild agave, which is all harvested in the wild. And then we have one of three different types of tequila, mezcal, and sotol. Sotol is another agave-based spirit.
Well, I must say, we're in for a treat.
Now, I just have
an adventure,
maybe. Matt, what are you going to do for an encore?
Just keep doing what we're doing and hoping that people start to take notice and realizing mezcal isn't something that they should really be afraid of, and it's something that they could really get into and study with the amount of diligence that people do with wine.
Well, there was one last thing we wanted to talk about.
Sure.
If you remember, we wanted to talk about the shape of the glass.
Absolutely.
The glass containers.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are really some fascinating and very beautiful shapes, characteristic of some of the European spirits, Grappa.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And why do you think that is?
I do believe that a lot of people in the tequila industry actually have had ties with the European wine market, and a lot of that actually does take place with their bottle shape and design. I do believe also that it does have a major marketing tool, in that people will design their bottle to be eye-catching. So if they're not familiar with the spirit, at least they'll like the bottle and possibly choose from there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been one of the more interesting 7 minutes we have ever spent. So thank you for providing that. Listeners, I'm sure you felt the same way. And now we're going to take a short break, but don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
One of the most fascinating things you can do in New York City, if it's a fine sunny day, as it was the day that we went to the next restaurant and chef that we're going to talk to, is to walk down a wonderful city park that's been created along some abandoned rail tracks running from about 14th Street to 30th Street on the west side. Yeah, a wonderful project called the High Line. And
which is still growing, it seems.
Yeah, it's still. Well, I think somebody said, although we didn't see it, that in fact it's now complete all the way from 30th Street to Gansevoort. We didn't start quite at that. I think we got on at 23rd Street, but most of Manhattan was there.
Oh, it was wonderful.
The crowd was immense. The sun was shining, the flowers were blooming, the long grasses were blowing in the wind. It was just the perfect way to get up an appetite to walk from Gansevoort Street to West 14th to a restaurant called Recette.
Which means recipe in French.
Yeah, there you go. But I just wanted to mention to you that, in fact, if you're of a mood during the spring and summer and fall of this year, this would be a great way to get there, because you can walk there all the way from 30th Street and work up a nice, handy appetite which we, of course, did too. So we had fun with Andrew
Schenker.
And here he is.
Reset is a new restaurant to me, but we're here talking to Chef Jesse Schenker, who's a Floridian. We don't really interview many Floridian chefs, actually, Jesse. But I guess there are a whole bunch of them now, like Mitchie and all those people. And
Yeah. No, Florida, I think everyone seems to be migrating north or to other cities, but I think there's a fair amount of chefs probably originated in Florida. You know, who would?
Yeah, but your food, you would never describe. Remember we had that phase where they did the, what was it called? The not New Floridian, New something.
Floribian?
Floribian, whatever.
I think it was Floribian. It was
that's
like a mixed
gone away, I think, now.
Yeah, that was the 90s. I think that's gone.
But you don't cook that way anyhow.
No. I mean, I worked for all the chefs that started that wave down there, you know, mixing the Caribbean flavors and the Latin flavors and Southeast Asian flavors.
Norman Van Aken
and
all those people, and, yeah. So I never really I don't like all that fruit with my protein, but anyhow.
No, me either.
But anyhow, you're way far removed from that. You're in Manhattan, and your restaurant is Reset, which is the French word for recipe.
Yes.
But the menu is not French, or it is French?
Well, you know, the menu's, it's definitely more New American. And I say New American because we use traditional techniques as well as modern techniques. And myself and majority of the kitchen staff are French trained.
So that's why you got this French name.
Yeah. And I thought
the restaurant doesn't look French.
No, definitely. It's got it's a rustic, warm, clean lines, very.
Where are we?
We're in Greenwich Village. We're on West 12th Street. So,
okay.
I think the decor is fitting for the environment, for the neighborhood. The food has really been built off travels and working in different kitchens and just what I like to eat, what I've read.
Yeah, you said what you do is the way you like to eat. Also, you like to taste things. You don't like to have big platters of stuff that you have to chow your way through.
Exactly
how I feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than going to a restaurant and having a salad or a steak or any protein. Exactly, it goes on forever. You have like four or five bites, you're kind of sick of the flavor, and it's not necessarily. You know,
That's like Thomas Keller. He says, second bite, already had it.
Diminishing return. I love his kit. You know, that he's a huge inspiration for me, and that's definitely a huge motivating factor behind the style of the menu. But when I go to eat, I want to try a bunch of different things. So when you come to Reset, I want you to be able to try a bunch of different things. This is not...
So these are all, tasting... Will you have snack?
Well, we have a snack section, which just tend to be one or two bites, and then we have charcuterie and cheese. We like to mess around with your own charcuterie as well as importing some good stuff. Yes, we do. I always like to have four different things. Two offerings we make in-house and two offerings that we get from someone, artisanal products that I couldn't possibly make. And then I love cheese. We have to have a cheese selection.
Yeah, and then plates.
And then I just do a list of plates. Yeah, so basically everything is completely composed. So it's not, I don't want to be confused with tapas. They're not tapas. They're completely composed dishes. They have a protein. They have garnishes. They have sauces. They have crunch factors. They just tend to be a little smaller in the portion size. We want to source the best products possible and really want each plate to pop individually. There's no throwaways on the menu. Everything is well thought out. And basically we list the plates from lightest to heaviest. So the salads and the crudos and the raw things tend to be at the top, and then more of the richer meat-heavy dishes towards the bottom. So it's not necessarily listed in the size of the plate, just in the richness of the dish itself.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
So, but now here we are, and we have a menu in front of us. And you're going to guide us. Now, how are you going to direct us to order?
Well, the top here, we offer a chef's tasting menu. We do 5 and 7 courses. This, I would say 45% of the people that come through here tend to get the chef's tasting menu. And that basically is a variety of dishes from the plate section. So if you have, we're great about mix and matching. So if you come in with a group of four and one person only eats fish, one person only eats meat, one person specifically asks the spaghetti and one person can't eat gluten, we do it. And you have four different tastings, but it's a good way. It's complicating, but it's we like the challenge in the kitchen, one, and two, it adds to the experience of the table where you can really try a bunch of things, and that was the ultimate motivation behind designing the menu Reset. Was I want people to try a lot of stuff.
Yeah, well, so that's how we like these.
Yeah,
what are your favorite things? What are you going to actually recommend that we order?
Well, you can't not try the salt cod fritters. So basically, this this salt cod fritter has become.
Well, that's weird. It's salt cod fritters with lamb sausage ragu and curry aioli. I've never heard anything like that. That's really off the wall.
It sounds off the wall, but it works. It works, and we go through a lot of salt cod. That is.
Yeah, but with lamb sausage ragu and curry aioli.
Well, I'm gonna let you try it, and you're gonna tell me. You're gonna be pleasantly surprised. This was a compilation of flavors that I had through my travels in Europe when I was younger. The fried salt cod from Spain and the bolognese from Italy, and
so
then
you put them all together.
And we put them all together, and then the curries in London, and just kind of I just experimented one day. I took some lamb shoulder, we ground it down with some spices, and we had espalette pepper, we had sherry vinegar, and it kind of just is this really rich umami flavor, and it needed something salty and it needed something crunchy. So what can we do? So we basically took a traditional bacalao recipe with potato and olive oil and lemon. We breaded them, deep fried them, put them on top, and we ate it together, and we all looked at each other and said, this is amazing, but it needs something. What does it need? Some kind of creamy aspect to kind of just tie the whole thing together. So I said, let's make a mayonnaise. So we start off with a roasted garlic aioli, and I had some bright idea to add curry powder, some Madras curry to the olive oil, and we did that, and it worked, and we experimented it probably the week after we were open, and the feedback was just amazing. We just realized everyone saw cod fritters. The servers loved it. The guests loved it. And it's really just became a signature.
Well, I mean, it's going to be a real test for me to try this stuff because I'm of this simple
person. Yeah, well, it's funny because it is quite simple. It sounds intricate, but it's really quite simple.
Many, many ingredients on a platter.
Yeah.
What was the other thing I was looking at that I thought was... Well, you did the sweet bread with escarole, brown butter, lemon, capers, and parsley. That's straightforward.
Straightforward.
Yeah, and then there was another one I saw that was straightforward. Then there were some other ones, like the lobster espuma with fava, smoked bacon, tarragon, and summer truffle was a little bit...
It's a little more complex, yeah. A little more technique going on there, but still very straightforward. Just delicious Maine lobster that we just fry the shells and make a really, really flavorful broth. And then we just charge it in an ISI siphon, so it's aerated, so it's light on the palate. Again, it's not really heavy on the stomach. We do a couple little pieces of lobster croquettes in there with the meat, a little bit of smoked apple smoked bacon, and some tarragon. And favas are in spring now, so we get some delicious fava beans. We do like a play on kind of like refried beans with favas.
It's a pretty extensive menu. I mean, you have a lot going on in your kitchen.
Yeah, we have a lot. I mean, hence we're only open for dinner because we're prepping all day long.
And how many people are in your kitchen?
You know what? I have the dream team. I have an amazing staff. There's only six of us in total, but there's one person that cooks the meat and the fish. There's one person who does all the vegetables, and then there's one person who does the garmager, the cold stuff, as well as the desserts.
And then you just sit back and watch it all happen.
Yeah, that's right. We opened January 2010. Yeah, so just over 2 years.
And who comes here, basically?
You know what? We really found that when we first opened, we had a little bit of press, and it kind of seemed to be more industry-oriented people, cooks, servers on their nights off, more foodie-driven people, and that we were kind of underground. And within the last year, the demographic has grown larger, and now we have people coming from the Upper West Side, from Connecticut,
really?
From Boston, from Long Island, from New Jersey. We have, the Bridge and Tunnel crew on the weekends coming
That's a
in.
Big draw.
Yeah, no, it's definitely gone well. I mean, we have a following in Australia, believe it or not. Yeah, we have, comment cards at the end, and we ask if you'd like your email address. If you give us your email address, we can keep you updated on stuff going on. And there's a lot of Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, but
there's
how many are those? How many Sydney, Australia people?
I don't know. I mean, being in the West Village, again, I mean, the meatpacking right there, it's very touristy around here. So we have a fair amount of tourists. Europeans that are coming through here, the tourists. Pull in from Tokyo the other day, and we were in a magazine in Tokyo. I didn't understand anything, but in the middle it said we're set, and it was a picture of our charcuterie plate, and she's like, I want that. So it was interesting.
Well, it's going to be interesting tasting this, because you have to prove
How about we list a couple more, just for the hell of it?
Okay.
Well, give us a couple more, Jesse.
Another favorite of mine that's became a real signature is the beef carpaccio. So this is, again, pretty straightforward. We get really good quality beef tenderloin. And
with the burrata in it.
Yeah, but we slice it very, very thin into a little cylinder, and we actually take fresh imported burrata cheese that we mix with olive oil and fresh basil, and we put it in the center of the beef and then roll it up into a ball. So it'll appear like a ball of raw beef, but in the center is the oozy, delicious, rich burrata cheese. I pair that with an earthy porcini mushroom puree. What we do is we save the heirloom tomatoes from the end of the season, and we make a jam out of it. and we actually jar it and freeze it, and we use it through the fall. And then, so we, it's a beautiful heirloom tomato jam that's brought down. We do a nice basil vinaigrette, and it's again, quite simple. Not reinventing the wheel, just kind of interpreting things.
What would you call this style?
It's hard to label. I mean, that's why I like to just say modern American, because we're in America, we're in New York. There's so many cultures and ethnic backgrounds and flavors
from everywhere.
Yeah, you can kind of really do. I can kind of, when you say modern American under that category, you can really do anything and get away with it. Especially being in Manhattan, because it's just, you name it. You want the best pickles, you want the best olives, you want the best Chinese, you want the best Japanese, Australian, Russian, Korean. You could find it in some borough, in some neighborhood in Manhattan.
Now, do you do one of these fancy dinner cocktail programs?
We try to keep it simple. I mean, we are only a 45-seat restaurant, so we have 5 signature drinks that we have. We've done really well with this blood orange margarita, which is a newer drink for us. We have a kumquat old fashioned that's really good. The kumquats are really nice because they have like a bitter, sour note to it. It really rounds it off.
What?
Old fashioned. So it's basically an old fashioned that we add some kumquats and some bitters to it. And then it's quite nice.
And what about your wine list?
The wine list is actually, we're building on extensively. We're a fair amount of domestic stuff, California, Sonoma, Napa. And we have a quite large Burgundy and Bordeaux collection. We have some great Rieslings from Alsace, some great Rieslings from Germany, as well as Austria. Some really nice Spanish wines. It's again, because we're a small restaurant, but I want to be able to appeal to everyone and have good variety. And
What's your next big reach? I mean, what do you want to do next that's different from what you're already doing?
Question, but I mean, for me, it's a challenge every day, just trying to stay on top of everyone and stay on top of everything and just keeping that quality and the standards high.
That's
basically
not bad to do.
Yeah, just staying, you know, just keep striving and keep learning. I mean, I learn every day something new, whether it's about wine or the business aspect or from another chef. Just continuing to learn and grow as a restaurateur and a chef and a business. And I like.
Okay, so it's now Recett, RECETTE.com.
NYC.com. RECETTENYC.com.
NYC.com. That's a good distinction there.
Yeah.
Well, Jesse, I'm really looking forward to trying all this.
Well, I'm happy to have you.
Well, I think that we should mention how absolutely splendid the 25th anniversary reception was after the award ceremony, because they brought back all those chefs that had won Best Chef in all those years, and they actually cooked. They had stations. And so you went from one great talent to the next great talent. And, I mean, it was just absolutely stunning. I have to say that I missed the cake. Did you see the cake?
I didn't. I saw where it was, but the crowd around it was so large you couldn't see it.
Yeah, I want to know what it is. I mean, it was done by the Ace of Cakes, and it had the James Beard House was the main body, and then they had a bottle of champagne leaning there, and I didn't know what that brown thing was on the other side. Do you?
And you did you? You must have seen a picture of it.
I did.
No, I didn't see it at all. The crowd was just rather large and rather boisterous. But we'll be back. We have to say this. We must say this, and we sort of forgot. James Beard is considered a father figure.
The father of American gastronomy.
Of American gastronomy. And it was on display. And I'm sure that he was up there chortling away with a glass in his hand and his favorite food in front of him, saying, I'd rather be at the party, but up here is not so bad after all. And I feel like I really did help 25 years that have gone by in the organization, the James Beard Foundation, and we're glad to see it continuing to prosper.
Right. Okay, so now we're going to wrap.
Is that it? Yeah,
that's
I guess
for today.
Yeah, that's nothing more. Till next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.